next case, which is case number 60313, Richard Zollo versus Travel Herbst et al. Mr. Eccles representing the appellant, Mr. Smerber, and I see Mr. Brandon here as well representing the respondents. So, Mr. Eccles, you may proceed. Did you wish to reserve any of your time for rebuttal?
Your Honor, I'd like to attempt to reserve about 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well. Okay, you may proceed.
This is a Rule 25 case for the substitution of parties, and we presented two main arguments in our briefs. Our first argument is the threshold issue, which deals with the service of the suggestion of death called for under Rule 25A1. And the second issue that we'll get to is the applicable standard of excusable neglect under the Mosley versus District Court case decided by this court. Now, on the service of the suggestion of death, the first argument we've raised is that the suggestion of death was admittedly not served on all counsel for the plaintiffs. It wasn't served on Mr. Nick Mastrangelo, who's co-counsel for the plaintiff. Now, if you look at Rule 25A, it says that the suggestion of death should be served on parties according to Rule 5, which is like service on counsel, and Rule 4, like service of process to the non-parties. So clearly, under Rule 5, the suggestion of death should have been served on both the Richard Harris Law Firm, who was co-counsel, and Mr. Mastrangelo. Now, the argument that the defendants offer is that because in the 16.1 disclosures, Richard Harris Law Firm had identified itself as the place where the witness could be contacted, for example, to serve a trial subpoena, that was going to be sufficient. And they even say, well, now Richard Harris Law Firm is the agent for Mr. Zollo, so we can just stop serving the co-counsel. The problem with that is NRCP 5C. NRCP 5C allows a litigant permission to not serve all the parties. 5C really only applies to co-defendants in these mass litigation cases, like construction defect cases, where we don't want to serve all parties. And then it allows a party to approach the court, get a court order, and say, we don't want to serve everybody, and we want your permission, and then the court approves that. In this case, there was no permission. I look at this issue as something like a prevailing party getting a judgment at the end of the case, inserting notice of entry of that judgment on only some of the non-prevailing parties, and then at that point saying, well, because you didn't appeal from the judgment, you've waived your appeal rights, while the non-prevailing party says, well, I never received notice. So a first service issue is just service on all counsel. Now, it's interesting to note that the motion to dismiss after the 90 days ran was served on both counsel. And there's really no explanation other than there was an oversight on the suggestion of death. It should have been served on all counsel. And that it should have been retracted at that point. Now, the second service issue that we've raised is again in the plain language of Rule 25A1. This is, goes now to Rule 4, service of the non-parties. Of the Rule 25 cases we have in Nevada, we haven't really seen one where there was a non-party that needed to be served. So we look to the federal courts that have decided this a lot. And really, we've cited quite a few cases in our brief, and I think probably the most succinct reflection of our position on this is the Barlow v. Ground case from the Ninth Circuit. Basically, it says there's a two-step process for serving the suggestion of death. There's the filing requirement, and then there's the service requirement. The service requirement requires that if there's a non-party, it has to be served as a right process. Now, one of the arguments that the defendants raise on this point is they say, well, Richard Harris Law Firm became counsel for the estate. But the key point on that, and that's the same argument that the opposition made in the Barlow case, at the time the suggestion of death was made in May 2011, Richard Harris was not counsel for the estate. And I think that can be, that's easily determined by the record. The responding appendix, there was a sole document, stipulation, order, continued trial, and discovery.
Page, Mr. Eccles, one thing that's kind of different in this case and trying to sort of, isn't the suggestion of death usually served by the party that passed away or his heirs and all that? This is the reverse here, even though it can be done that way, but it kind of triggered the these time limits and all like that. Is that your experience? It's usually served by the representatives of the party that died?
Well, I think it can be served both ways.
I understand it can be served both ways, but that's kind of where the confusion happened on whether it was served properly by the respondents here on the parties and the attorneys and all.
Yeah, and I think the Mosley case does a good job of pointing out the two approaches. There's the Bennett approach, mm-hmm. and then there's the Bardo approach, mm-hmm. Depending on which side's serving the suggestion of death. And one point I'll make about the Mosley case on the service issue. Mosley involved a wrongful death case, and then the representative of the estate in the already existing wrongful death case, he himself died. And that's where the Rule 25 issue came into play. So all the heirs were already parties, and so you didn't have a Rule 4 issue. It was really just a Rule 5. Everybody's already here, serving with the suggestion of death. Back to my point about Richard Harris Law Firm was not counsel at the time in May 2011 when the suggestion of death was served. Respondents Appendix Page 5, this is Section 3, it says, both counsel, it says respective counsel been diligently working on discovery, and both parties need additional time to conduct discovery with regards to the estate to be substituted. So at that point, there was no representation counsel. The kind of intermediate issue that we've offered is prior to the expiration of the 90 days, if it was in fact triggered under, you know, overcoming the two hurdles of our service arguments. If both of those are overcome, we have this intermediate argument, and it's based on this Anderson case from the Third Circuit, which has been cited favorably in federal practice and procedure. What the Anderson case says is, listen, Rule 25 requires the motion to substitute in 90 days. It didn't really go into the service issue. And it says, we admonish counsel to follow the rules. No different from this case. But it says, in the pretrial memo, it noted that there is going to be a substitution of parties. There's going to be this estate. And the Third Circuit said, we know the district court didn't look at this. We can't chastise the district court for not allowing the substitution of parties. But we're going to take the record as a whole, and in the interest of justice, construe this statement in the pretrial memo as a motion for substitution. Now, we didn't raise Anderson in the district court, but if you look on, I think it's page 51 of the record, which was in the motion to dismiss proceedings, not the rehearing, but the original motion to dismiss proceedings, it says from counsel's pleadings that an adequate party has been identified, and the party was identified as the administrator for Mr. Zaro's estate, and that was filed in this case prior to the expiration of the 90 days. So our alternative argument is apply Anderson, look at the notice of who this party was. Between the time that the notice of entry of order of that administrator until the expiration of the 90 days was like 4 days. So we'd ask you to construe that notice as a motion to substitute. Now, moving beyond that argument, we get to the Mosley versus District Court standard that was established by this court in 2008. Before I get into the Mosley discussion, I think it's important to note that there were only 16 days that counsel missed the 90-day deadline, if my math is correct. From the time of the suggestion of death until he filed his counter motion to substitute was 106 days. So he was only 16 days beyond that amount. Certainly, it falls within the realm of excusable neglect just based on the short amount of time. The fourth prong of Mosley, prejudice to the defendants. what prejudice can they really say they have?
Well, I'm concerned about that. I'd be interested in what opposing counsel says, because it appears that Judge Smith said or he doesn't think there was proper grounds for excusable neglect. And I know the order written doesn't set forth any 60B factors in the analysis on that. So what impact does that have under Mosley?
The only representation that I could find in the record, Your Honor, is in, I think it was a reply, a motion to dismiss proceedings, where they said that they're prejudiced because now they have to go to trial 6 months later. That is really not out of line, because all they had was a stack that they were going to a trial, so there's no guarantee they were going to trial. And 6 months is not very long anyways in the world of trials. In
this case, one second, on a small point, dealing with one of the problems, and that is that you said, well, it's only 16 days. Does 17 days become too many? Does 50 become too many? You know, help me out.
No, I understand, Your Honor. I mean, it is a discretionary type of issue. And I think in order to address that properly, you have to really go through all four factors. After reading through Mosley, I think this case really quite largely mirrors the George versus United States case that's addressed and relied upon in Mosley. And one of the things that happens in the George case is it talks about the estate was being prepared. That was done in this case. Counsel had talked with the other counsel, they advised them that was done in this case. And another thing that was done with George, it talks about a misplacement of documents, and then that's okay as an excusable neglect. Now, the range of, you know, you're going beyond 16 days, you know, if you go 20, 30, I mean, how late are we going to go? I mean, some of that's going to fall into the district court's discretion.
Case by case.
A range of these factors, the Mosley factors.
Okay. Did you want to reserve the balance of your time?
I will.
You've got 3.5 minutes. Okay. Mr. Smober, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, may it please the Court, Justin Smober, Ryan Law, on behalf of the respondents. Your Honor, the issues that have been raised today first pertain to the service of the suggestion of death and then the method of the suggestion of death. With regards to the first arguments raised regarding service of the suggestion of death, it's the respondent's position these arguments were waived. When the motion to dismiss was initially filed before the district court, the plaintiff's attorney, appellant's counsel, raised one issue in opposition to that motion. That opposition was that excusable neglect existed. There was no request that the service of the suggestion of death be found effective or any argument that the 90-day period had not been triggered. The motion to dismiss was granted, and it was not until the motion to alter judgment, which Judge Smith construed as a motion for reconsideration, it was not until that time that the arguments regarding defective service were raised. Immediately upon those arguments being raised, the respondents argued that those arguments had been waived. In accordance with this court's precedent, points and contentions not raised in the first instance cannot be raised upon a motion for rehearing. That was the argument that we presented to the court. Now, we did follow through because we didn't want to not address the other arguments. However, that was our primary argument. And in hearing argument from counsel on the rehearing, Judge Smith found that persuasive. After listening to argument from the appellant and listening to argument from myself, he specifically inquired to appellant's counsel, are you telling me that a party can completely fail to raise issues on an initial motion and then raise those issues on a motion for rehearing? The response from the appellant was, yes, you can, and I have a case that demonstrates that. And Judge Smith said, I am going to continue these proceedings for you to provide that authority to me. And the reason he did that is because he did not believe that you could raise these arguments on rehearing. He then, after an extended period of time, issued an order saying, I am denying this motion in its entirety. The reason why that is relevant is because the appellant has said the case of Arnold versus Kipp properly brings these new arguments before this court on appeal. However, important to the holding in Arnold versus Kipp is that the lower court level court elected to entertain those arguments on their merits. I would submit to you that Judge Smith did not do that in this case. He specifically inquired to counsel, what authority do I have to to listen to these new arguments. He wasn't provided with adequate authority because he denied the motion in its entirety. Therefore, I would submit that these newly raised arguments are not properly before this court, and the holding Marvin versus Kipp is not applicable here. However, if this court is inclined to consider the arguments made with regards to defective service, I would still submit to this court that the suggestion of death was properly served. The first argument offered by counsel is the argument that all counsel for the plaintiff was not served. They cite one case in support of that theory, which is the Quinlan versus Camden case, which is completely inapplicable to this matter. Quinlan versus Camden involved an offer of judgment being served by way of facsimile. Well, Rule 5 specifically says if you are going to serve by facsimile, you are required to have written consent. Rule 5, with regards to suggestion of the party's attorney, says you may either serve a party or their attorney. The suggestion of death was served upon Richard Harrow's law firm. I think it's important for the court to understand the context of the litigation at that point. The operative complaint in this matter, the amended complaint, was filed by Richard Harrow's law firm. The 16.1 conference was noticed by Richard Harrow's law firm. It was attended by myself and David Bowler of Mr. Richard Harrow's law firm. We then formulated a discovery plan. We filed and signed a JCCR. We proceeded forward with discovery. I was handling this litigation. I was not dealing with Mr. Mastrangelo in any form.
Did he sign the complaint initially, or how was he involved in the case as far as making a general appearance in it?
The initial complaint was filed by Mr. Mastrangelo's office.
So did Mr. Harris's office is associated as co-counsel with Mr. Mastrangelo?
They did, and then they filed an amended complaint which became an operative pleading that was signed by Richard Harris' law firm, David Bowler.
Yeah, but did Mr. Mastrangelo ever withdraw from the case, or did the client sign a substitution of attorneys naming Mr. Harris as the sole attorney?
No, you are. And I'm not contending that Mr. Mastrangelo had withdrawn from the case. What I am contending, though, is that service was made upon the attorney actively handling this litigation. When we were finally notified of the death of Mr. Zolo, that came from a conference that I had with Mr. Bowler. He contacted me and said, Mr. Zolo's passed. This is the state of the case. I then prepared the suggestion of death, and I served it upon Mr. Bowler. He was the attorney handling this case. I would submit if there is any error, which Rule 5 does not specifically say, each and every attorney who may be representing a party is required to have service. But if there is any error, it would be a harmless error, because the actual firm handling the case was provided with that suggestion of death. The next issue that they raise is the method of service. And the argument is non-parties to this litigation should have been served in accordance with Rule 4, and that service upon the attorney was insufficient. I would submit that this very court has ruled very clearly that in a circumstance where a defendant is filing and serving a suggestion of death, they do not have a duty to locate non-parties and serve them. Quoting directly this court's language from the 2008 opinion of Mosley, this court stated, and I'm quoting directly, here, petitioner, a defendant, in the underlying proceeding, filed a suggestion of death for a plaintiff who died during the proceeding's pendency. Because petitioner is a defendant and it is a plaintiff who died, petitioner was not required to locate or wait for the designation of successor for the deceased plaintiff to successfully trigger the 90-day period. That is direct language from this court, not from a federal jurisdiction, not from the Ninth Circuit in Barlow. That is this court's opinion. And that is exactly what happened in this case. Mr. Zolo passed away. A suggestion of death was filed by the respondent, the defendant, in the underlying proceeding. There was no obligation for the defendant to go forward and locate a successor representative and serve them with anything. That is this court's precedent. That is the current state of law in Nevada. I would also submit to the court that if you were to accept the theories and the law set forth in Barlow, it still would not resolve the dispute before this court. The reason is, in Barlow, the court specifically declined to address situations such as the one involved in this case. In Barlow, the deceased plaintiff's attorney disclosed his will and identified the representative of the estate. The Barlow Court said, under such circumstance, you would have to identify that person as an interested non-party. You have been notified that there is an estate and a representative, and in that circumstance, you should serve that person in accordance with Rule 4. We did not have that circumstance in this case, because on May 12th, when I was on or about May 12th, when I was notified of Mr. Zello's death, there was not a disclosure of a will. There was not a disclosure of an estate representative. I agree with counsel's contentions. When I prepared the stipulation in order to allow an estate to be created, one had not been created yet. That is why Barlow is inapplicable. I could not go out and serve in accordance with Rule 4 the successor or representative of that estate because it did not exist. And based upon this court's holding in Mosley, I didn't have an obligation to do that. So even if the court were to accept the appellant's contention that Barlow is controlling, that still would not resolve this issue. And even though Mosley is not factually detailed as the Barlow case, I would direct the court to the cases referenced by the Ninth Circuit in Barlow, specifically the Yovanovsky case, which is a federal district court case in New York. In that case, the suggestion of death was served upon the deceased plaintiff's attorney, and that was challenged by the executor of the deceased plaintiff's estate. And the federal district court of New York said, when you have a situation where an estate representative has not been identified yet, and that person is not known to the defendant has no one else to serve but the deceased plaintiff's attorney. That is the proper person, and they found service of that suggestion of death effective, and they found that it triggered the 90-day period. I would also direct this court to the opinion from George versus United States, which is a Connecticut case, and I think it has significance because in the Mosley decision, this court referenced the George opinion. And again, in the George opinion, a plaintiff died, and the plaintiff's attorney was served with a suggestion of death. The defendant did not serve anyone else, and that service was challenged by the wife of the decedent, who became the executor of the state. And the George court explained, at the time of the filing of the suggestion of death, there was no administrator to serve. Accordingly, service upon the attorney was proper. Finally, with regards to excusable neglect, the Mosley case sets forth four factors with regards to excusable neglect. Good faith, diligence, reasonable basis for noncompliance, and prejudice. I want to address those factors briefly. Good faith. Mr. Zello died in January.
Let me ask you a question before you do that. It doesn't appear Judge Smith addressed those factors in either a verbal ruling or in the written order. Am I incorrect in that?
I'm very hesitant to tell Your Honor that you're incorrect. However,
I am talking about the arguments.
I believe that he did.
Okay.
There was one argument presented to Judge Smith, and Judge Smith was presented with a single argument that we prepared the motion, we had it ready to go, there was a file transfer, and we simply didn't file the motion. That was the only factor that he was presented with, and his response was, I do not find the mere failure to file a motion to be excusable neglect. I think that that's clearly distinguishable from the George case.
But the concern is, there's four factors. We don't have a full record that considers those. I appreciate what you're offering, but that's the concern we're looking at.
I understand, Your Honor. And what I'm getting at, and perhaps I'm not articulating clearly enough, when Judge Smith was presented with an excusable neglect argument, he was not presented with argument on four factors to address. He was presented with one argument. We just didn't file the motion. And I argued the factors, the four factors of Mosley. I represented Judge Smith. Listen, in terms of good faith, Mr. Zello's death wasn't provided to the respondent for almost 4 months. During that time, appellant's counsel is continuing to attempt to resolve the case, submitting offers of judgment, they're continuing to litigate, they're disclosing experts, all without telling the respondents. During that time, they're also waiting for discovery to expire because it wasn't until the eve of the close of discovery that they came forward and said, hey, listen, our client died and we need to continue discovery. The arguments I presented to Judge Smith, and I believe Judge Smith considered those. Also, in terms of diligence, Again, let's look at the timeline. Mr. Rosillo dies in January. Respondents are not notified of the death until May. Letters of administration are not prepared and filed until June. And no notice of that is provided to respondents until August, 8 months after his death. We have an 8-month delay that's created by the appellant in this case. Clearly, this isn't a showing of diligence. The next issue is the reasonable basis for noncompliance. And I'll submit to you, this is not similar to the George case. In the George case, the court found that an estate could not be opened and an executor could not be appointed because they were missing important financial documents preventing that administration of that estate. We don't have that here. In quoting the George case directly, the George case stated, the delay was not due to the inaction on the part of plaintiff's counsel, but instead on the loss or displacement of documents necessary to complete the appointment of Mrs. George as the executor. That's completely opposite of what we have here. This situation simply involves the failure to file a motion. This case, the other case that was cited by Mosley, also valued by this court, was the Al-Jani versus Rockefeller opinion. And in that case, you had a failure to appoint an administrator and file a motion for substitution because the court found that the deceased plaintiff's family and his attorney were purposely obstructing the filing of that motion. The family was refusing to be appointed as an administrator. The attorney for the deceased plaintiff was saying, there's nothing in the estate, we can't proceed forward, we can't file this motion. Again, these are factors which would consider or constitute excusable neglect. We don't have those factors here. What we have is a simple failure to file a motion to continue or to substitute. And I think that the bare or limited opinion by Judge Smith at the lower level is because of the limited argument presented in terms of excusable neglect. He was presented with one issue. We did not file the motion. His response to that was very simple. I do not find in your failure to file the motion to be excusable neglect. And I will submit upon that unless the court has any further question.
Questions? Thank you very much, Johnson. Mr. Eccles, could you address the issue? Let's say we agree with you that both attorneys had to be served. You know, and we haven't even discussed that, but I'm just saying hypothetically, if we agreed to that, would that have been waived if it wasn't raised as part of the initial motion by your client then?
Now, we've cited to Arnold v. Kipp, and you know, Arnold v. Kipp is a case that says you can raise new issues, new facts, in a motion to reconsider. And the factors in order for that to apply is the motion to reconsider has to be in the record as it is. It has to be filed before the notice of appeal is filed. It was. In fact, it was a tolling motion. And the judge has to actually make a decision. He has to choose to consider the arguments on the merits. If you look at the order denying reconsideration, which was prepared by defense counsel, it says in there, and it mirrors the minute order, that he considered the arguments. If you also go back and read the transcript, Judge Smith didn't have any notion that he wasn't going to consider all these new arguments. In fact, he said, I'm interested in some of these cases, and he wanted to go back and read, I think it was a North Dakota case, and then I'm going to issue a decision based on a minute order. So I don't think there's any waiver of any of these arguments based upon the Arnold v. Kipp precedent.
Okay.
Also, in the recitation by the other side, they indicate there was something like an eight-month delay from the time of the party's death, and there was no action taken by plaintiffs.
And that's not entirely correct, Your Honor.
That is correct.
January 2011 was the death. For about 4 months, there was some discussion of whether there was going to be a settlement. There were some settlement offers made. That's not uncommon. In the Barlow case in the Ninth Circuit, it talks about after the death, there's still settlement negotiations. Also in the Costello v. Castler case, which although not a Rule 25 case, it talks about settlement discussions made after the death. Once you get to about the five-month mark, is when you get the suggestion of death. That's the 90-day triggering period, if it applies. A month after the suggestion of death was this document I referenced in the respondent's appendix that says each party, both defense and plaintiff, are doing discovery to figure out who's going to be the successor or the representative. So really what you have is there's this initial period of 4 months where there's not a lot of activity, but then after that, it's like a monthly deal where something's going on. Let me talk briefly about the Barlow case. And in the Mosley case, the court talks about there's no duty for defendants to locate the heirs and the successors. We're not suggesting that anybody had to locate anybody. In December 2010, counsel for defendants took the deposition of Mr. Zollo at his house in Henderson while his wife was there, while his grown son, Thomas Zollo, who's now the administrator, was present. And there were questions asked about, you know, who's your family? So they were at his house. The address is listed on the deposition. There's no question that this is a case about they know who the heirs are. They know who the successors are. We're not proposing to the court that they go and look for unknown heirs. All we're proposing is that they serve the process, the known heirs. Thank you, Jones.
Thank you very much. We appreciate your arguments. And again, I might add something. Mr. Eccles, of course, you always do an outstanding job. Mr. Smart, first time I think you've argued was in front of me. I don't know, my colleagues. I really thought you did an outstanding job, you know, like that, with the first argument. So anyway, we will take the matter under submission, and we'll see you. We'll call our next case at 11:30. Mm-hmm.